Thank you so much for attending again the second day. So to kick it off for this morning, Ziv Nakajima again, please. He's going to tell us all about mistakes first-time buyers often make. Also, before he does start, I do want to say a very, very big thank you. I do want to say a very big thank you. A lot of this is thanks to Ziv. You know, of course, Blanca, Tracy, myself, we've got a whole crew that do work on this, but he is definitely the force that drives us all and is, yeah, that too, a whole bunch of stuff. But yeah, so thank you, Ziv. So just maybe a quick round of applause just to say thank you to Ziv for helping execute this whole event. But now, mate, hand over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Jordan, I'm wearing this suit for you. The moment you've got enough footage, let me know so I can take it off, please. Thank you. Okay, so a quick introduction before we get started. I'm co-founder of Nippon Tradings International, which my partner, my wife and myself set up about 13 years ago now. And what we've been doing since the get-go is helping foreigners, whether they're resident or non-residents of Japan, navigate the real estate market as their proxies. So we can represent somebody so that they just need to talk to us and make bottom line decisions and we'll handle everything else on their behalf. Or we can come as consultants in various capacities for people who are comfortable doing things on their own, but just want somebody to hold their hand, give them advice, review documents before they sign them, that kind of thing. We've been running the Japan Real Estate podcast for the last 7 or 8 years, which is a good resource for a lot of people. I know a lot of you have heard of about this summit through the podcast and came here. So highly recommend to anyone who's interested in anything that has to do with Japan real estate, including the speakers here. We have a panel that comes on sometimes. A lot of good stuff to be had there. So anywhere, search online, Japan Real Estate Podcast. It's the only one out there. Feel free. So we've been helping people with a lot of stuff. We've started out mostly with investment properties, which was what the first thing that we purchased for ourselves. We realized that the offers in Japan are quite attractive for various people for various reasons, but the market is hard to navigate. Direct communication with Japanese professionals, aside from in a handful of locations, are quite difficult. And then we figured out that there might be people who could use help with that. We've been doing investments only for a good few years. And then just before/during the beginning of COVID and the Akiya boom and all of the international attention that vacant homes or just generally property purchases in Japan gained internationally, we started gaining more and more requests to assist with that. Main reason being, again, that aside from a handful of locations, people interested in buying these kinds of properties really don't have anyone to work with. Things have changed a little bit in the last few years. Agents now receive inquiries from foreigners, and some of them will try to use various translation tools. The more savvy, advanced ones will actually hire an English speaker or a Chinese speaker or a Korean speaker to have on staff. But the vast majority of the professionals, especially as you get further and further from the major metropolitan centers, are not very foreigner oriented. And even if they do decide to try, often communications freeze after a few email exchanges when the questions get a bit too complicated. And the Japanese still to this day, in many cases, rather than just straight out rejecting or saying no, will just disappear into the ether because it's not polite to reject someone. So we get approached by people who have hit walls in various steps of their communications with the agents or whoever it is that they're trying to get service from. But even when they do work through us or with us consulting them, they still hit walls at various stages of the process. And a lot of these walls, similar to the topic of the presentation we had in the last summit, a lot of these walls have to do with preconceived assumptions and not necessarily, I don't want to say mistakes, because these assumptions do work in other countries, but things can be a little bit different here. So last summit we talked about the way to communicate with these agents and how to, you know, manage the relationship with the proper expectations on both sides. You can download that if you go to the summit page. Today I'd like to talk about not necessarily investment, but a lot of it will be investment related, just mistakes that people make about general stuff that they expect to work the same in this market, not necessarily on the human side, just practically, and the kind of mistakes that that can lead to, these preconceived assumptions. So any of you have been already working here in Japan in various capacities or have been purchasing and buying and managing and selling real estate, you'll probably recognize some of these. You might not be relevant to you at all because you're already well adapted, but anyone who's entering this market for the first time or is still trying to navigate through it will probably, hopefully, find some value in some of this. So I've broken them down into a bunch of categories that people tend to make assumptions on that are not always 100% correct. The first one is the type of asset classes that they invest in. Second one is the locations that they pick. The third one is what their concept of accessibility. So within a certain location, you've picked a town for whatever reasons, then where do you purchase inside that town and how accessible does what need to be? Everybody knows the 10-minute walk to a station rule, but we'll break that down a little bit more and understand where it actually comes from and which properties or tenant profiles might be even exempt from that. People often make some misconceptions related to yield, the yields that they see online, the yields that they think they'll be getting from a particular property, the types of calculations they make that might or might not be relevant here in Japan, depending on what they're buying. And then two more vague, definitely not woo, it's very practical stuff, but two more vague umbrellas that people tend to often make mistakes and have preconceived assumptions on. One is how things actually work, and the other one is the importance of money, like the budget that I have, the amount of it that I'm paying in cash, that sort of thing. So we'll dig into them one at a time. I'm hoping somebody will give me a sign when I'm going out of time, because I can talk for hours. Okay, so asset classes. The most common preconceptual assumption that people make when they enter a market coming from a first world, I don't want to say Western because it's a thing in Asia as well, but generally the assumption is that the most common and simple and easiest asset class to buy and manage and that we'll have the most demand for is the single family home, right? We're everybody coming from, definitely from Australia where I was before I came here, but a lot of places in the US as well, even in Europe to some extent, people assume that the house with, you know, the biggest possible lawn or backyard that will house a happy family is the best asset class to invest in. Not really the case in Japan. So as you might have heard if you were here yesterday or in other talks by other presenters in various aspects, houses in Japan can be profitable. They can be a good investment. You can find a good tenant. But there are a few factors that you need to take into consideration there that people are not necessarily aware of. The first is that, and most important one, I think, is that wooden structures in Japan, which is most of the houses, in the last 10 or so years, we're seeing a little bit more concrete becoming a bit more common, but most of the houses in Japan are wooden structures. And as opposed to wooden structures in other countries, they're not really built to last. It's kind of a built-in assumption that the house starts to deteriorate and needs more and more checks at 10, 15, 20, 25 years, 23 years from memory is when it's, from a tax perspective, completely depreciated, the structure is. And as they hit 30 and definitely 40 and 50 years of age, the average amount of money you'll need to pour into them every year steadily increases. And the biggest issue with that is that it's not really stable and expected expenses that you'll be running into. So you'll have 4, 5, 6 years, everything's good, then the roof goes, 20, 30,000, you fix that. It's time to renew termite protection, 5, 6, 7,000. You've done that, then the retainer walls that is holding your house elevated from the ground and needs to be rebuilt every, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years. That goes, which is another 10 million. It's just, unless you're the DIY type and have the time on your hands to and the knowledge or at least the local connections, like in Anton's presentation yesterday, of people who can come and do the work efficiently and cheaply for you, that's going to be taking more and more and more of your time. If you're buying a brand new family home, then yes, you've got about 20 years before that'll be something that you'll need to consider, but the yields on those would be pretty low. So the typical asset class in Japan. The single family home as we know it can be a good investment for people who are interested in being that hands-on, either mentally or physically. Next asset class that a lot of people have this image in their head that they'll immediately buy into and make turnkey profit is your yokan or Airbnb out in the countryside or guest house, onsen resort. People have this image of these, you know, very cheap, dilapidated but easily renovatable assets that are, you know, scattered around the countryside that anyone can buy into and start operating tomorrow. Not the case. I think to those of us living here, it's quite clear why that's not the case. There's a lot of marketing and hiring and licensing involved. The bigger the structure and the more traditional it is, there's more and more and more work involved in maintaining it. Again, doable, people are doing it, but a very hands-on experience. So from the perspective of a, I don't like to use the word passive, but semi-passive income investor who's looking for a regular paycheck every month without having to worry about decision making more than once every few years, definitely not. And then there's another version of that, which is the ski lodge. So people, again, assume that they'll buy a villa in a nice little resort that's got onsen water supply all the way to the apartment or the cabin, and they'll be renting it out Airbnb and making a killer profit from all of these tourists who will come to use it. Doable, but not on resort grounds. The vast majority of resorts owner unions will not allow any kind of rentals, let alone short-term rentals. There are a few exceptions to this, like Niseko, places there where the international community is heavily ingrained into the local municipality, but those places are usually quite high to purchase in. They're already hotspots that have long since peaked to reach the level where that would be doable there. So again, unless you're very hands-on and marketing very, very well, that's a very hands-on job to actually generate money from that. If you've got your own cabin or vacant house out in the countryside that you're using as a holiday home and you want to make money on it when you're not, like Tracy was talking about yesterday, that could be doable in some location if you find somebody who can take care of the property, if the local municipality makes it easy for you to manage it remotely, and a lot of them don't. If you can find cleaners in the area, will come in regularly. So again, potentially doable, but requires a lot of research and a lot of hands-on attention. So what asset classes are typically easier and more manageable for an investor? They're not as sexy as any of those, but one of them is your typical single bedroom, maybe two bedroom, older mansion apartment room, somewhere between 20 to 30 years on purchase, hosting a single person, which in many cases will look like that or like the female version of that. Potentially single mom with a toddler, maybe a couple without children. Easily manageable in the sense that those are very docile and hassle-free tenants. They would rarely make any requests of you. There are some exceptions, like very bored old men with a lot of time on their hands, like we were discussing yesterday, but usually they're going to be hassle-free, at least during the tenancy. When they move out, you might find out that they didn't want to contact the property manager for a bunch of stuff that was broken, or, you know, close the windows and smoke like a chimney all day. So there is work involved. But the other advantage of these smaller layout, smaller floor plan apartments is that you can actually easily and relatively cheaply renovate them in between tenants compared to a family home, especially one when you're also in charge of maintaining the structure itself. So those are low maintenance compared to the price you purchase them in, relatively high yield. They can be found in any big city, even if suburban, within 10-minute walk to a station, somebody needs to live there. They're kind of like the cash cows of the Japanese property property market, and they're very hands-off in the vast majority of cases. If your budget allows you to, you can stretch that into a small apato, 2, 3, 4 unit. That's a bit of a old school one. They usually look more like that, depending on when they were built. 2, 3 floors, somewhere between 4 to 12 single rooms or single units. That again could be, if it's a younger building, they'll probably be small but with a loft kind of thing, a bit more windows, a bit more air going into them. Even if they're older, up to about 20 years, they could be maybe small family sized again, so somewhere between one room to two rooms plus dining kitchen, up to maybe 50 square meters in size. Again, very easy to find tenants for these kinds of properties compared with a Japanese family tenant as well, just because of Japan's population trend being what it is. Granular families, pretty small, single child at best. A lot easier to find a tenant, a lot easier and cheaper to renovate in between tenants. The families are great if you have a single family home and you've figured out how to maintain it, you know, efficiently and profitably, and you do find a family tenant to move in there, they'll stay for longer, they'll take better care of the place compared to the singles and the couples. But when they move out, it will take you longer to find a family to replace them, and it will cost you more to renovate definitely the interior, and as the structure gets older, a lot of the exterior as well. So that's about asset classes. Locations. So first-time buyers to Japan tend to fall into the loop of the same three types of locations, at least we've identified over the years. First is obviously Tokyo, biggest city in Japan, biggest city in the world, if not one of. Constant flow of tenants moving in and out, various city centers, always accessible, or in vast majority of cases, quite accessible. And what a lot of people, when they imagine, when they think about Japan's declining population, say, well, Tokyo is the only place that will always gain in population continuously. Not true, by the way. We've got a, if you signed up for the pre-survey, you got a edited, amended kind of population census PDF that we've edited to show the actual locations that are growing in Japan in order of cities, city wards, and the actual growth over the last 2015 to 2020, which is when the last census came out. There are quite a few places in Japan that are gaining in population aside from Tokyo. Generally speaking, like we were saying at the Q&A panel yesterday, all of the smaller townships that are dying out and drying out means that people are conglomerating to the biggest metropolitan center nearby, and from those into the biggest cities, the top seven. So most of these locations, aside from a few, are always at least stable or gaining in population, and all of them will have far better yields than Tokyo. In Tokyo, the price graph is rising up because it's an international hotspot. Price graph is rising much more sharply than the rental graph, and that gap is where you use your, lose all of your yield. So Tokyo, at best, net before tax, you'll get maybe 3%, 3.5%. If we get to 4, we're ecstatic in Tokyo. Other cities will go up to 6. If you're buying a small building, 6.5 on purchase in good locations. You can get higher on purchase when you go to more third-tier cities and prefectural capitals and bedroom communities. But there, again, it's yield on purchase. When you have a vacancy, it'll take a bit longer to fill, and you don't have the added value of potential capital growth, which might or might not happen. But all of the big locations, aside from Tokyo, will give you much higher yields and much more affordability, which also translates into diversity. So you can buy three assets for the cost of a single one in Tokyo. It gives you socioeconomic, geographical diversity, never a bad thing to have with investment portfolios. Okay, other default locations that people in their mind get into, tourist hotspots, right? Everyone goes out to Kamakura on the weekend, therefore it must be a good idea to invest in Kamakura. Or everyone has heard of Miyoko and Nozawa, therefore a good idea to invest there. Yes, it's a good idea if you're running a tourist hospitality property and you can market to the types of tourists that will get there and you can get the licensing and again become a very hands-on job. If you're thinking that a place being popular for tourists means that it's also popular for normal tenants, not always, right? Kyoto is. But Kamakura is not. It's not really a rental kind of market out there. Same goes for, let's say, Nara, right? Very popular for day trips. Everyone goes out to Nara to see the deer. Population is declining, not many people living there. You're looking at rental tenants, not that easy. Your own holiday home may be rented out when you're not using it, different story again, but not the ideal investment hotspot. And the last one is nostalgia. I taught English, like Nick was saying yesterday, I taught English in Shikoku in the late 80s. Love the spot, it's beautiful there, I'm gonna invest there. No tenants, property managers charge 10% because there's only two of them in town. Population again declined, industries leaving. Aki Amart Boys told us yesterday that there's no clear trend of Shikoku ever gaining any kind of traction or value, not the best place to invest in, right? So put the emotion and the headline reading aside and focus on where you can actually get bang for your buck, which is, again, all of the other top cities. So Yokohama, central Yokohama at least, Fukuoka, Osaka, Kyoto, if we can find a deal out of there, usually more houses. Sapporo and Nagoya as well, with the caveat that Nagoya has more of a blue-collar population, so occasional early termination of lease, a little bit of payment issues, could be a bit harder to find a tenant that'll pass the guarantee company's check, and just a bit rougher around the edges, still Japan, but compared to other cities. And Sapporo, which is one of Japan's biggest cities, but the winters there can take their toll on landlord expenses. Vacancies are much longer. If you happen to get a vacancy in the winter, it'll take you a long time to find a tenant. Nobody wants to move around when it snows. And similarly, a lot more equipment that can freeze and break down and require expensive replacement. So both good cities to invest in as well, but we would like to see slightly higher yields on purchase to compensate for that over time. So satellite cities, bedroom communities, which we've discussed, anywhere within preferably 45 minutes, but up to an hour from a major metropolitan center and with convenient access, not somewhere you have to jump three or four train lines to get to work. And those are all good locations to invest in. You're losing the potential growth in yield, which again may or may not happen, that you'll have in other locations, but you will be able to buy them there cheaper and with higher yields as well. Vacancies, not as long as winter in Sapporo, but vacancies can be a little bit longer, but usually worth it. The extra yield will still be higher than the safe and stable, more major metro centers. And prefectural capital. So the biggest city in an otherwise rural prefecture, like Kumamoto City down in Kumamoto, Saitama City, not that Saitama is that rural, it's 30 minutes from Tokyo, but Saitama City, the biggest city in Saitama Prefecture, those kinds of locations will always keep drawing tenants again from all of the emptying little villages and towns around them. Not a bad investment, again, barring a few particular locations like two major cities in Shikoku that I keep forgetting because we don't have many customers investing there. Okay, so accessibility. Again, we all know the 10-minute walk to station rule. Some people seem to think that everybody has a car in Japan. That is most definitely not the case. Your typical lower slash middle income earner who's renting one of those studio or one, two-bedroom units does not have a car and does need to be within 10 minutes walk to a station. That station cannot be a bus station. I mean, it can be a bus station. You'll eventually find tenants for those properties as well. And definitely, if you're investing in a city that has only a bus network, you don't have much of a choice. But that's probably not the best city to invest in to begin with. It should have at least trams slash subway slash train stations, and the property needs to be within 10-minute walk to that. If it's a studio or two-bedroom or where your typical tenant is not likely to have a car. If you're buying a family-sized property, slightly different story. Most families will have at least one car between them, so that can be further away from the station. It can be a more attractive residential area. But the biggest station in the city, let's say you're buying something near or one of the near Shinjuku Station or Tokyo Station or in Fukuoka Hakata Station, that can be up to 15 minutes. Tenants will still walk the 15 minutes if it gives them complete accessibility to anywhere they want to go. But beyond that, the 10-minute rule and not to a bus station is probably a good one to stick to. And depending on the type of tenant that you want to get, even a 10-minute walk in an otherwise boring suburban area for your average salaryman is a bit of a stretch. So you will definitely find people for properties that are far out in the suburbs, as long as they're, again, within a 10-minute walk to a station. But the further they are from the center, the harder it will be to find tenants for them. So eventually you will, but it could take a minute. By the way, university campus adjacent properties can be a good idea, but if you lose a tenant midterm, you're probably going to be waiting 3-4 months until the new term starts before you'll find a new tenant. So they're not as good as they tend to be in other countries. Okay, so assumptions on yield. Assumption number one, people kind of take the listings that they see on Japanese websites at face value. That couldn't be further from the truth. Depending on the agent, depending on the website format, some of them list super gross yield, like that only take the rent and divide it by the price of the property, not including even building fees in case of a condos, not including purchase costs, not including property management costs. Any listing you'll see online will be, in the case of a entire structure, like a house or a building, it would be somewhere between 1 to 2% off the actual net yield that you'll be getting. In the case of condo units, it can be 5, actually I should have written like 6% off, because we always deduct 4 in our mind before we even put it in an Excel sheet, and sometimes it'll be more than that. So don't go off the listing, put the numbers into your own Excel sheets, which we can talk about later, and we'll have samples of it upstairs as well. Whatever yield you've got on the property on purchase will always shrink. Japan's rents as a whole, because salaries and have not really gone up significantly, just a smidgen in the last 15 years. Cost of living has definitely gone up way more than that. Consumption tax has increased twice. As long as we can't raise the rent, our yield will always shrink. We're buying a structure which is naturally gaining more and more wear and tear with age. Whether it's condo unit contributions to the reserve funds or something that you're taking care of yourself if you own the entire structure, unless Japan's economy makes a major U-turn and rents start going up as they do in most other countries, which again hasn't been the case in 15 years, assume that your yield will always shrink. It'll shrink slower if you've bought something a bit more, a bit newish, like let's say under 20 years. You'll start with a much lower yield, but that yield will remain a bit more stable for at least a couple of decades. If you bought in a super central location, rents will go up at least a little bit, maybe enough to cover the extra maintenance costs. So they might stay the same, but generally over time, depending on various factors, they will always shrink. So the fact that you bought something that's generating 6% now, you can kind of assume that within 10 years it'll slowly start creeping towards 5%, then 4%. Consider that when you're considering when you might want to resell it. Assumed yield is not real yield, meaning, again, property listings that you see on Japanese websites, some of them are tenanted, some of them are vacant. The vacant ones seem to write in the exact same field what they assume the rent will be, which is not the real rent because there's nobody in the property at the moment. Agents being agents, apologies in advance to any agents who are here in the room with us. I know Emil's not like that, but he doesn't do investment properties. They will blow up those figures. They'll base them on the highest possible rent that they found in their research. They'll base them on stuff that's listed but hasn't actually been tenanted yet, which means that the owner will be reducing. Do your research. Check by yourself what comparable properties in that area are being advertised for. Try to see in the archives of some of these websites if they actually got complete listings and how much they were rented out for. Ask your agent. They can look in some of their databases. I'm not sure if there's rental data on Rains, but they can definitely check to see what properties have been rented out for in that area, not the listing agent. I mean, whichever agent is helping you directly, the buyer side agent. Or companies like ours, we can do that for you as well. But don't assume that if it's a vacant property, don't take anything for granted by what the agent's writing in the listing. It's most likely inflated at least a little bit, sometimes a lot. And even if you do have a tenant in there and they're paying a certain amount of rent, which is, wow, it's, you know, it's, this property is gaining, I don't know, 8%, 9%, tenants in Japan are very, like most Japanese people, are very conflict averse. And from their perspective, negotiating the rent with your landlord is conflict. So when their tenancy lease reaches its automatic renewal, which is a thing in Japan, every 2 years they get automatically renewed. Even if the rent that they were paying is pre-bubble days rent, which is not rare if you've got a 60, 70-year-old gentleman or lady living in one of your properties, they might have been living there for 30 years already. The concept of, you know, purchasing to buy rarely crosses their mind, or they don't have the financial ability to do that, so they'll continue to rent until the day they die. They'll be paying the rent that they've paid pre-bubble days, which could be twice the amount of the comparable rent is, but the thing is that when they move out or pass away or move to a nursing home, you'll be getting half the rent, because that's what these types of properties. They wouldn't move out, they wouldn't negotiate the rent, they want things just to remain the way they are, so they keep paying the same fee, even though it's nothing to do with market fundamentals at the moment. But when you get a new tenant, you'll be back to reality. So whatever your rent you're getting now, make sure it's actual average comparable rent in that area. And spreadsheets. I can't emphasize this enough. Double check everything that you see online, put the numbers into your own spreadsheets, make sure you're doing the right calculations to see what the real monthly payables are, what the real purchase costs are, what the actual net pre-tax yield is. If you know which tax bracket you're on, you can add post-tax yield, like pure net. If you got mortgage payments, you can factor that in. Put everything in a spreadsheet. It's an investment. It's not an impulsive lifestyle choice. It's an actual financial decision. Okay, so things that we first-time buyers coming in, and the biggest culprits for that is people who are actually experienced. So people who have done property deals in other countries, they have an investment portfolio, they know exactly what works and how to do everything in Australia. It's a little bit different here. So these are some of the assumptions that we tend to make. If it's our first time, I know I've made those mistakes at least a couple of times. They know what tenants like, but they don't. They know what tenants like in their country of origin. They don't know that a Japanese tenant would prefer to never speak to the landlord and only ever speak to a typical Japanese property agent. And even that, they'll avoid doing as much as they can. They don't necessarily like the funky modern design that you think would be awesome and attract those more artistic types or student types. They might just be looking for something that really does look like an empty hotel room, you know, with wallpaper and this kind of flooring at best. Or don't assume that you know what tenants like just because your tenants in another country like it, because it's often not the case. You do not know your rights as a landlord. Japan's legislation, we talked about it briefly yesterday at the panel, Japan's legislation is very tenant-oriented. Leases are automatically renewed at the end of every 2 years, and you need a very good reason to not renew the lease. You can't inspect a tenanted property, even if you're purchasing or selling it every year. Like, you know, when we were renting in Australia, the property manager, if we're lucky, they would have notified us. Otherwise, they just knock on the door and say, hey, inspection, and just come inside and have a look. Doesn't happen here. You will be buying sight unseen if you're buying a tenanted property. There's a bunch of things that you cannot do. You can't raise the rent unless, again, you have a very good reason to and can back it up in market fundamentals. Make sure that you do know your rights as a landlord here in Japan rather than think that you do from whatever you've been investing in another country. You think you know where to save on costs? For example, yeah, that wallpaper looks okay to me. A typical Japanese tenant walking in has certain expectations, even if they're not thinking about them consciously. They know what a new apartment should look like. A bit of yellow on the wall, a bit of a dent on the floor, a bit of a rusted hot plate, stuff that would definitely find available tenants in most other countries. And it might even find available tenants here in Japan. But if you want to repopulate your property as quickly as possible, because a month of missing rent income, especially if you've got a condo unit and you're still paying the building fees, a month or two or three of missing rent income will cost you much more than you're going to be saving on just making the place look like a rental unit is supposed to look like when a Japanese tenant walks in. I mean, listen to your property managers. They usually know what they're doing. They've been doing it for a while. Other assumptions, like people assume, somebody told me, I think yesterday or the week before, that they were shopping around for properties, and every time they walked into one of those tiny realtor offices with the signs curb window, and the single person sitting in there with a tiny phone, they're like, oh, that's not a serious agent. Let's go to the big one, to the Ekimae. But the good deals are actually there. It looks like a shoddy operation, but boots on the ground actually knocking on these small realtor offices that maybe don't even advertise on the internet. And like Anton was saying, they got a drawer with stuff that they've been keeping for somebody like you. They do exist. They're the best place to do it. Similarly, knowing that a certain type of tenant profile is necessarily better than another, like I'd like a student rather than a middle-aged woman in her 50s. I'd like a person employed by a company rather than a person employed at a convenience store. You might think that you've got the right kind of idea of how things work elsewhere. They just don't work that way here. And equally, how property markets work. So all of the assumptions about rent always goes up, property doubles in value every 7 years. Major metropolitan centers will always attract more crime. I mean, all of the things that we might be used to in a particular country that we've been working in the past might be, again, a little bit different. I would argue that all of these assumptions about property prices and capital gains and rents always rising, I don't think they're 100% as accurate as they used to be in other markets as well. They're definitely not that way here. We've had a deflationary economic environment for 25 years, kind of bottomed out and slowly crawling our way out of it. Tokyo, Osaka specifically, have gone up to where they were pre-bubble days, but where's the seven-year cycle? Like, that? Don't make assumptions, they're not necessarily going to work. We like to tell our customers, focus on cash flow with a bit of potential for maybe capital growth if you've invested in the right locations, but don't assume that's icing on the cake. And lastly, I know I'm totally out of time. Lastly, money. We assume as first world country investors that walking in with suitloads of cash and telling people that we don't need a mortgage and we can sign straight up and send them on their way to go and get the best property deals for us, that doesn't work here. A lot of people will prefer not to do business with you regardless of how much money they stand to make if things are not as smooth as they expect them to be, and that counts for the actions that you take, the way you behave when you're walking through a property, the way you shoot emails at a certain frequency or pick up the phone and call them at a certain frequency, assuming that they speak English. If they don't, actions, behavior, same sort of thing. We talked about that in more detail in the last summit. Definitely stuff that will get you ghosted, whether you have a lot of money or not. Being a foreigner, you are already an exception when you come to deal with these agents, unless they're super foreigner friendly in an area that justifies that, but that's rare. You need to adapt yourself as quickly as possible and try to get over that hurdle of already being an exception to the norm that would cause a lot of people not to work with you. And company policy. If a certain agent works for a certain company and that company insists on things happening a certain way, a property being sold, contract signed by a certain date to meet their quotas, you having to get something from the embassy as opposed to a normal notary public, you can try to dance your way around it and try to convince them that you want to close the deal, but if that's their company policy and that's what the boss tells them they have to insist on, then that's not going to change. That's it. Questions? Sorry, I've taken way over too much of your time. Hand stream. Yep.
So you said the 10-minute rule, like walk from a train station. Is there
or tram, or if it's a tram town.
Okay. Is there ever a problem about being too close to the train station due to noise or something like that?
Not for the lower income earning tenants and the lower cash cow type of properties that we normally deal in. If you have a condo unit in a big building right near the station, which is very noisy, your tenant most likely just goes there to crash, sleep, and then run back off to work early the next morning. They prefer the convenience and they don't mind the noise that much. And with the newer apartment buildings, you're probably, depending on your budget, you're probably not going to buy them that close to a station. But if the tenants are a bit of a higher profile, then yes, they would mind that. Those are usually towards the edge of those 10 minutes and probably further away from the station.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. What is the city in Tokyo area, the satellite city in Tokyo area?
The what?
Satellite
cities in Tokyo area. The
examples.
Tokyoites in the crowd probably know that better than me. I think all the way up to Hachioji in the west, between Tokyo and Saitama City could be considered to be satellite cities as well. But Tracy, Emil, anyone here who can comment on Tokyo better than I can?
Sorry, can you repeat the question? We're just reading the stream.
Sorry.
Repeat the question, please.
Yeah, good satellite cities that are convenient enough to get to Tokyo and might be interesting to invest in.
For holidays or for residential?
Typically residential, I think, yeah. Like places where people live that are easily accessible to Tokyo.
Chiba, I would say, like, you know, Kashiwa, Matsudo, I mean, because it's great if you have that line through to Narita. That's a really, and there's a lot of universities along that rail as well. So that's a really good one. Or even along down to Atami, down to, I want to say, like, Zushi, all of those, that people commute from Zushi on a regular basis. And then you've got the beach as well, the beach aspect. So down there, you don't want to go too far in off the coast in that area because then you sort of hit some dead spots. I'm unsure about Kanagawa. I get a lot of questions about Kanagawa, but I don't know that area very well. Like Kawasaki, that type of place. So I'm not an expert on Yokohama or that.
No, me as well. I mean, we are based in Fukuoka. We work all over the country, but if it's not the city where we're based, then we will simply look at the map, make sure that it's within 45 minutes, if possible, and on a single train line. That's usually the definition of a bedroom community.
If we're in Fukuoka, it would be like 30, 45 minutes to Hakata Station or something like that?
Yes, if it's in Fukuoka, I would say within 45 would be pushing it, because Fukuoka has more room and cheaper properties. You can actually usually find a property people in Fukuoka are spoiled in the sense that commute is very easy around the city. It's nowhere near Tokyo, so Fukuoka specifically, I'd maybe go for 30 minutes rather than 45.
The question from the stream, you mentioned in a recent podcast, Yuzawa is on the rise. Do you know the profile of people who have been buying there? What kind of properties do they buy?
People that we constantly get are Australians who are buying holiday homes for their own personal winter holiday use, and quite a few entrepreneurials within that ski community who are looking to set up short-term stay operations of various sorts. I'm still not sure to tell you how feasible that is in Yuzawa, but I'm getting the feeling not that easy.
Guys, I did a renovation in that area, and when you buy a property, you have to count on a lot of expenses to renovate those places, so be careful. It's a cold country.
Just as a follow-up to that, that's a better option to look at a single-family dwelling rather than in one of those mansions that are selling for $1,000, but then you've got that added expense of, you know, because we did the sums on that, and it was like, you know, 40,000 yen a month for the kundi here, and if it's not renovated, you sort of, you know, yes, you're buying something for $1,000, but then you're dropping another 20 grand to do, you know, to something that hasn't been looked after. So yeah, it's hit or miss. And then if the fees haven't been paid, you're up for that too.
Yes, thank you, Tracy.
Thank you, first of all. So would you say in Japan that anything for the market fundamentals, like related to NOI or MPV or anything, does anything significantly change, or do those metrics, like, are they still generally valid in this country?
That's a little bit over my pay grade. We deal with cash buyers mainly, so we're limited to deals of, at best, maybe 2 million US. To get really significant market statistics, you need to look at bigger numbers than that, so I can tell you. All I can say is, from our experience, assumptions about potential growth, difference in cap yields between gross and net, those things were vastly different to formulas that we saw elsewhere. So we just caution people against it. I beyond that is a bit over my pay grade. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
That makes it easier for you. Yeah, next question's there.
Yeah.
Buying an apartment in a big condo building seems like the sweet spot. What happens 30 years down the line or whatever when the building owners decide that's it, we're crashing that building and rebuilding, if you're an owner?
Yeah, so first I'll caveat to say it's a sweet spot depending on your budget. I personally would say the sweet spot is an apartment building, because then you get the bigger land plot, you get more flexibility of what you can do with the units, stuff that owner union won't. So if you can afford it, I'd say they're the sweet spot. With condo units, we normally recommend to buyers to buy them between 20 to 30 years on purchase, which is, again, that sweet spot for yield versus it not being too old that I need to be concerned about dropping it in 10 years' time. As it gets closer to 40 years is when we would advise to sell it, not because the building is going to be torn down and demolished, but because building fees just increase as it requires more and more maintenance. That most of the Japanese investors who will be buying from you don't have other options overseas. So for them, when you sell close to 40 years, you'll drop the price a little bit. The yield will be not high enough for you, but will probably be high enough for them. So you'd normally be reselling them far before demolishing is even anything that comes up in owner union talks. And the developers are a lot more savvy than owner union members usually. They'll start sniffing around and warming their way into, if the location is attractive and they want to buy the property, they'll warm their way into the owner union, get, you know, a few units at a normal price, then have more voting rights. Eventually, they'll convince them over a campaign that'll take them up to, what, 10 years, which is what happened to us in most cases. And then the whole thing will be sold to a developer, not at a huge profit for the owners, usually same price they bought for or less, but everything will be sold to a developer if it's an attractive location, which is where we would recommend to purchase from the start. So that will be sold off far before it'll even be a consideration to demolish or not.
In the recent UBS report, that Tokyo is the second bubble risk for property. What is your take on that?
I agree that Tokyo prices are a lot way more inflated than they should be. Bubble is a word that I don't use lightly in Japan because socioeconomic and the nature of the debt, which is held mostly domestically here, kind of prevent, it's more like a deflating than a burst in the bubbles that we've had here in the past. I mean, we had the big one in the 90s, but it's not, again, rents don't go up beyond a certain point, but if prices continue to go up, so all of the speculative investors will eventually not be interested in Tokyo anymore because the yield is just not there. And I do believe that when crisis will hit, if and when it will hit, it'll be more of a ceiling or a, you know, a slow deflation rather than a bubble burst and everybody losing their money. But again, that's the kind of thing that's a bit over my pay grade. I will say Tokyo is definitely overinflated for what it pays yield-wise. And most people that we work with know that. But institutional investors who are happy with anything beyond the 0.003 that they get for whatever they're allowed to invest in, they're still okay with 1.5 to 2.5%. So until that shrinks below that, I think it'll still continue to feed that market. But macroeconomics, again, not my thing, I'm sorry.
Thanks. Oh, there was one back here. Oh, there you are.
And then back to the front.
So could you comment on access to healthcare and education and the decision-making process? And I would imagine it's different if you're looking for a single-family home versus, you know, your bread and butter apartment building investment.
Yeah, so proximity to a hospital is important because a large proportion of your tenant base is elderly. So proximity to a hospital is quite important. Convenience of transportation, again, more elderly tenants are actually usually a bit more comfortable taking the bus than going up and down subway and train stairs, but you'll be limited only to the elderly population if you don't have accessibility. So I'd say convenience to supermarket, convenience store, and hospital are the main things we look at. And from that perspective, we don't mind being a little bit suburban. If that's the question, did I answer the question?
Guideline of like 20 minutes, or like what would you say for those kind of things?
That's hard to say for me. 10 minutes to a hospital is difficult. I mean, there's not going to be too many locations that satisfy that. But I'd say within an easy one or two stops train ride at worst, which is, yeah, about the equivalent of 20-minute walk. But I mean, our walking pace and the elderly gentleman going to get treated at the hospital is a bit different. So I'd say our 20 minutes, which for them could be a bit longer.
Yeah, I just have a question because you mentioned that for mansions, the sweet spot is 20 to 30 years.
Yep.
But for apatos, they are generally much,
wooden
much
structures,
older. They are much older.
Yeah, no, not the ones that we recommend to buy. I would say 20 and younger for any wooden structure. 20 years and younger. 30 years and younger for a concrete structure. Just thinking about where maintenance expenses will start to escalate, I'd say about 30 years here, 40 years there. We good?
Anything else on the stream, Blanca?
I hear all the time. Don't invest on the 1K apartment, but the way you sounded today, it was a good investment.
What's the reasoning behind that? It's lower income, lower profile tenants. I completely agree.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I hear that all the time by the Japanese, the real estate people.
I'll need to hear why they're saying that to comment on that. I don't know. I mean, could be that they want to sell bigger and pricier ones, or it could be something with actual logic behind it. I don't know.
Okay, but you don't think it's a bad investment?
I would say that if you're okay with potentially slightly more fluctuating yields, but you want to aim for higher, then that's a good investment. I would advise people not to focus on potential capital growth, because that's always a question mark in Japan. Obviously, not the case in Tokyo, central Tokyo at least, but anywhere in Japan, that's a bit of a gamble. So from our perspective, we focused on the highest, easiest to manage cash flow that we can get, and we find that in not necessarily 1K, 1R, 1K, 1DK, 2DK, 2LDK at most. Beyond that, unless it's a particular deal that happened to have higher yield, the yield tends to drop. So that's when we drop it. And older than 30, younger than 20, kind of things we mentioned before.
One more from the stream, please. Can you recommend trustworthy translation agencies to use as go-between to handle negotiations? I'm learning Japanese, but I'm not even N5 yet. Any communication for me with property manager ward offices, etc., would have to go through these agencies.
Tricky, because it's not that they're not reliable, they would most likely be professional and reliable, but if they haven't worked in real estate, then a lot of the terms will fly over their head, and the simple difference, we had this before, the simple difference between a septic tank and a kumitori pump toilet, if they translate the kumitori as septic tank, you're in for a whole stinky bowl of mess when you purchase. So I would advise the best thing to do is to hire a real estate agent. Just pay them by the hour, a bilingual one, obviously. Pay them by the hour. There are quite a few agents who will agree to do that. Normally, they're not that expensive, somewhere between 4,000 to 6,000 yen an hour. Or someone like us, we're probably at the upper range of that, but not much beyond that. Hire them to go with you, join you in a meeting, attend a viewing, pay the expenses that'll cost. That'll save you, again, a whole lot of trouble.
Can I just follow up to your statement as well? Is this for a single 1K purchase or a building of 1Ks?
Just a single.
A single of 1Ks. Because I know that Ziv and I last year did a yield analysis between the long-term rental and short-term rental yield of like a building of 1Ks. And clearly for a long-term rental, the yield outstripped any sort of short-term rental yield on a 1K. That is very different if you're looking at a yield from short-term rental at a two-bedroom and above. So it really does depend on what your what your plans are and what your goals are. So, but if anyone's looking for that comparison, it's on the past. Yeah. Yeah, it's one of the past ones. We actually did it.
We can send you. We'll go upstairs now while Alicia is doing her loans talk here. But anyone who wants to actually look at research and at spreadsheets, we'll do that upstairs now. And the version of it that compares to short-term stay, we can also send you separately. Thank you very much.
Oh, one last question.
Sorry. Okay.
what are the average fees of a property manager?
Yeah. Average fee as a property
manager.
Yeah,
how does that play into the yield?
Normally 5% plus tax, so 5.5% is the industry norm. It's not mandatory license, so they can go further up and down. They'll definitely discount it if you're managing a bunch of properties with them or if they're managing the whole building. It could be 3 or 4%. In areas where there are not many of them, it could be up to 8 or 10%. We've seen a few cities like that. And they also charge between 1 to 2 months of rental income when they place a new tenant. Thank you very much.